Okay, well, let's get started. Welcome to the June 2025 DMSC Masterclass. This monthly program brings together current DMSC students, faculty, and anyone interested in the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences, A.T. Still University. Today, we have the honor of learning from one of the true masters in our profession. A few housekeeping items before we begin. Please keep your microphones muted during the presentation. Feel free to share questions or comments in the chat, and we'll address them during our Q&A session at the end. Dr. Beth Popre, our program manager, will be monitoring the chat throughout our discussion. So I'm really thrilled today to introduce our distinguished guest, Dr. Ty Flewelling, DMSC, PA-C, all the way from Bengay, Africa. And where it's midnight, I understand. Dr. Flewelling represents the pinnacle of what it means to serve as a healthcare provider on the global stage. As a career member of the Senior Foreign Service and Senior Medical Attaché for the U.S. Department of State, Dr. Flewelling holds a Doctor of Medical Science in Global Health and maintains board certification in both primary care and surgery. Over 3 decades as a U.S. Foreign Service diplomat, he has delivered exceptional healthcare in some of the world's most challenging environments, serving everywhere from U.S. Everyone from U.S. presidents to entry-level officers and their families. His responsibilities extend far beyond clinical care. Dr. Flewelling develops critical health policy briefings for U.S. ambassadors and congressmen, and monitors emergency infectious diseases and provides real-time epidemiologic data during outbreaks. He's also responsible for comprehensive disaster preparedness planning, including shelter-in-place protocols, mass casualty responses, and nuclear, biological, and chemical emergency preparedness. Throughout his career, Dr. Flewelling has served at U.S. embassies around the globe. Lots of them, I probably can't pronounce half of them, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Turkey, Dominican Republic, Mozambique, Israel, Cambodia, Germany, and the Central African Republic. He's also held leadership positions as clinical director of Medevac Center Operations in Pretoria, South Africa, and deputy director in the Office of Medical Clearances in Washington, D.C. Before joining the State Department, Dr. Flewelling served as deputy director of the Navajo Nation Health Foundation Emergency Medicine Department, providing critical emergency services at 25,000 Navajo community members. His journey began as a paramedic, a career spanning 13 years that took him from the first paramedic class in Sioux City, Iowa in 1982 to diverse settings including Las Vegas, Nevada, the Nevada Nuclear Test Site, Casper, Wyoming's Life Flight Helicopter Service, Albuquerque's Lifeguard Air Emergency Helicopter Services, and Orlando Emergency Medical System, just to name a few. Beyond his medical career, Dr. Flewelling has served in educational leadership roles, including school board chairman for the Tashkent International School and chairman of the Walworth Barber American International School in Israel. He's married to Svetlana, I hope I said her name right, Flewelling, and their 3 children, therefore reflecting the family's really international spirit. Their eldest daughter, Diana, is also a Foreign Service officer, and I could go on and on, Ty, but welcome to our master class.
Yeah, we don't want to. We want to. We don't want to use up the hour with just the introduction. So, thanks, Randy. I'm delighted to and honored actually to be a guest speaker here on the Masterclass program, and delighted to be with you all.
Well, excellent. Well, let's jump right into it. We're really eager to hear about your journey in the PA profession. Could you share your early experiences, back in the paramedic days, transitioning from paramedic to PA school and then into clinical practice?
No, absolutely. So, as you mentioned, I started in the early 80s. And it was interesting. I started on a basic volunteer ambulance service in the small farming town that I grew up in, and transitioned into a professional ambulance service. And that was all in Northwest Iowa. And have had a call into the bright lights in big city and moved to Las Vegas, Nevada. And it was an extraordinary time. I really had an opportunity to experience a variety of of work in sort of pre-hospital care. I worked street ambulances. I worked on EMS helicopters. I did ER and clinical paramedic work in a number of different places. And for me, as I was completely consumed with pre-hospital care in the 80s. But by the end of the 80s, I was really looking to be able to expand my medical knowledge. And folks had told me you should go back to medical school. And by the time I was in my late 20s, the thought of needing to take a couple of years to get the prerequisites to get into even the under the bachelor to finish my bachelor's and then go on to medical school, I was looking at literally being in my late 30s or early 40s before getting out, and it was just not the trajectory that I wanted to go. And I remembered growing up in Northwest Iowa. We had a PA that worked for the family practice clinic that I went to as a child. And his name was Don Smutzer, and he was from the Kettering program. And he graduated there in 1976, and he was highly regarded in our farming community. And I felt that if I had sort of the same sort of medical acumen that Don Smutzer had, then that was really what I wanted to do. And so, Randy, as you know, in the early 90s, there were only 32 PA programs in the entire United States. And so I cast a very wide net, and I interviewed to PA programs across the United States. My first interview was in Salt Lake City. They were having a blizzard when I interviewed. Then I went to St. Louis. They were having an ice storm. And then when I went to the University of Florida, they were outside in shorts sunning themselves on the campus lawn. And I said, I know where I'm going to school. So I was fortunate that the University of Florida picked me up. And I managed to graduate in 92 from the PA program. I was honored also during that time to be a National Health Service Corps scholar. And so the National Health Service Corps helped pay for PA education in return for serving in a healthcare professional shortage area. Which I went to the Navajo Nation Health Foundation, which was my first job as a physician assistant. And I have to tell you, in terms of a great place to start, I had a fantastic group of physicians that we worked with. And as they would say, you've got book smarts, but we're going to make you clinically savvy. And they really did. And we had a really good team. And that really was what sort of launched me into, sort of going overseas.
Excellent. Well, tell us a little bit about in 1995 when you decided to go into the Peace Corps. What was that experience like? And did that shape your perspective on global health?
It really did. But I jokingly tell people that the Navajo Nation Health Foundation in Ganado, Arizona, was my first overseas experience. It really was an opportunity to work in a cross-cultural healthcare environment. There were different issues with language. There were different issues with culture. And those 3 years on the Navajo Indian Reservation really set me up well for venturing overseas. And so, it's interesting. On July 4th of 1995, or so 2025, will mark 30 years since this Foreign Service adventure began in earnest. And I was given an article out of an esoteric nursing administrator magazine for a Peace Corps medical officer position. And I thought, well, this sounds very interesting, and it would get me overseas. And so I sent a letter of inquiry on July 10th, and 60 days later, I'm getting off of a plane in Ashgabat, Turkmenistan, going, do I know any Russian? Yeah, so it was a very interesting over initial experience. And while the Navajo Reservation really helped establish that foundation of cross-cultural engagement, language, and culture, my foray into the former Soviet Union, and I was there. The Soviet Union broke up in 1991, and I arrived in 1995. And Turkmenistan, as a nation, was still trying to figure out who it was and what it wanted, and its healthcare system was really sort of on its back heels after no longer having the support from Moscow and on the greater Soviet system. And so it was a very interesting beginning. Learning about Russian medical standards, healthcare in a very remote and austere environment. Turkmenistan is a long ways from anywhere, being able to sort of, and this was all back in the day before computers and smartphones and having a bunch of things on your tablet. So you really had to have a sense about knowing what you know and knowing what you don't know. And was really surprising for me is that this young PA shows up in a city in the Central Asian area, and I was the sole trained Western medical provider. There were no one else. There was no one else in Ashgabat or in Turkmenistan that was Western trained, and it was what the U.S. Embassy gravitated to. It was what the other U.S. what the other foreign diplomats gravitated to, and it was a different experience because I hit the ground and was an instant celebrity, and I wasn't used to that. We're used to being sort of clinical PAs. Kind of being there to be the to do our best work in the shadows and to be at sort of the forefront of sort of diplomacy and the healthcare industry in Turkmenistan was surprising and unexpected.
Excellent. Well, you've accumulated, I'm sure, incredible experiences across the globe over the last 30 years, and it would take us 2 days to hear all of your stories. But could you share some of your most memorable or impactful moments over the last few decades that would be, certainly interesting for our viewers today?
Sure. So I have served in, as you read out, 12 different countries, and each country has sort of built my understanding of health diplomacy and global health. Each country has been different. Each country has had unique challenges. And you're right. Every assignment has its own series of stories. But if I were to pick out three, I'd say that the first sort of the first big one was after I had finished in Ashgabat, Turkmenistan. I went to Tashkent, Uzbekistan, and that was in my first embassy as a medical attaché, dedicated with the U.S. Embassy. So I had a diplomatic title. I had access to government officials. I had access to the Ministry of Health. And it was through that I started to learn how to build relations with host nation officials. And through those contacts, I was able to uncover a very large HIV outbreak along the Silk Route that ran from Pakistan up through Central Asia into Russia. And we used that information that I was able to develop to build a program with USAID and the CDC to help start to tackle HIV in a country that didn't want to even acknowledge that it existed in the country. I was also during my time in Tashkent able to travel out and see firsthand the Aral Sea disaster and the healthcare impact that it was having on the population in and around of that ecological disaster as well. The next sort of assignment that was sort of sentinel for me was in Ankara, Turkey. I was in Ankara for 9/11. I was down along the Syrian border when the towers and the Pentagon was hit, as we responded to that and as we prepared for the second Iraqi war, I found myself heavily engaged with our Department of Defense colleagues in preparing and supporting their mission as we built a coalition to basically take on Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And the third country I would say is when I was in Cambodia. That was right at the beginning of COVID. And in fact, before COVID was declared sort of as a global pandemic, we were starting to see this new viral pneumonia that was showing up in the country. And we had literally 20,000 Wuhan Chinese coming into Phnom Penh every single week. And in November of 2019, literally half of my embassy was sick with a viral pneumonia, and many of them had O2 sats that were in the low 80s. And so, it's like, I don't know what this is, but we're going to treat this as a viral pneumonia. Unfortunately, it was the initial Wuhan strain, which was not as virulent as those which came up in the Alpha and Delta strains that occurred later. But it really helped me in an understanding sort of global pandemic response. Cambodia was, I became the tip of the spear for working with a team from the National Institute of Health, from the CDC, and others to basically start to track and figure out the sequence of this genetic pathogen. And it was a very influential time for me in sort of understanding global health, health diplomacy, and how we respond to things on a global scale.
Wow, those are great experiences. Well, let me ask you this. We're so honored that you completed your Doctor of Medical Science with us at A.T. Still University while you were stationed out over there, and that certainly, in my mind, demonstrates remarkable dedication to do that. After 30 years of practice, what specific knowledge gap or capability drove you to pursue your DMSC, and how has it transferred your approach to diplomatic medicine?
I want to start by saying, Randy, you are the inspiration for why I did this. And I can't remember exactly the series of sequences, but you had been interviewed by Michelle Cambron on the Medicine Couch. And in listening to your interview with her, I realized that even after 30 years, that getting my doctorate is something that I could still do. I had felt that, oh well, I'm at 30 years in this career. There's I don't know if this is really going to be something that would be beneficial for me. And you convinced me, you talked me into this, and I'm so glad that you did. The DMSC course in global health was really amazing, and it was amazing from a number of aspects, and that every single aspect of the program really reflected what I was doing in real time on the ground here in the Central African Republic. The discussions on the political landscape of global health policy, or PAs in healthcare, or the community health educational programs, these were things. I mean, I was I well I was pr producing things for the class. I was eager to basically take it to work the next day and say, these are the things that I'm going to start implementing. And quite frankly, I did. There have been some dynamic changes with the new administration, which has cut foreign aid, but we have already planted the seeds for the things to develop, telehealth, and AI enhanced telehealth for the Central African Republic. We're working on improving maternal and child health care in the country. We're working on improving nutritional access, and promoting grassroots humanitarian efforts that are planted in the communities that need the care, and then are linked by telehealth and Starlink satellite to centers of medical excellence in Africa, in Europe, and in the United States. And AT still has been there with me through this whole journey during my entire 2 years here in the Central African Republic. And it's just been phenomenal. I've really, really enjoyed it. And it's made a difference. It's made an impact.
Excellent. Well, thank you for saying that. Well, drawing from your extensive experience in the PA profession, and obviously your experience certainly globally, may give you a pretty interesting perspective on the whole issue that the PA profession's looking at now, and that's the issue of optimal team performance. And as you know, that was something that the AAPA has started a number of years ago, and each state is working to change their statutes, to get rid of some of the archaic laws out there. But what's your view on an OTP, has that affected you at all in your current job?
Well, it really has, because I would say in a global health setting, especially in underserved countries, finding the best, most cost effective treatment is central, because healthcare dollars in underserved countries is scarce, and it's not a focus of many of the nations that I've worked in. And so PAs can play a really a central role in being able to identify optimal performance opportunities, but those opportunities look different from country to country. And here in the Central African Republic, it is tragically the worst healthcare I've seen around the world. When I was in Cambodia at the Khmer Soviet Friendship Hospital, it reminded me it would be like the Cleveland C Clinic compared to anything that's here in Bangui. And so it's a matter of being able to create teams. It's a matter of being able to build coalitions of stakeholders that include local community, host nation, the government, and NGOs, and to create a dialogue where these communities come together and they talk about their challenges, they talk about their successes, and they start to build opportunities to sort of lift the community as a whole. One of the things that I've found, especially here, is that everybody is eager for us to participate. While I've been here, there is a PA by the name of Mike Taylor, who actually started a hospital, a local hospital, here in town. And it's all NGO based. It's basically they provide from donors, and they train the healthcare providers and nurses in the country to be able to improve the quality of care in the country. So yeah, optimal team performance is central to what happens in an underserved country.
Excellent. Well, another thing that, as you know, that the AAPA has done a number of years ago was the big title change from physician assistant to physician associate. Talk to me about your view on that, and my guess is that you may not have to deal much with that because of your position as a medical attaché, but tell me what you think.
Well, so as we say, back in the day before the name change, when I was out in meeting healthcare providers and host nation hospitals and clinics, I was the embassy's medical attaché. So I introduced myself with a diplomatic title, and then explained to the providers in these hospitals what a physician assistant was. And so the term assistant has been somewhat a challenge for us in an overseas environment, because most folks look at that as a non-medical aid, and not as a trained healthcare provider. But by being able to introduce myself as an attaché, as a medical attaché, the diplomatic title opened up doors that allowed me the opportunity to explain what a PA was and how we practice in the United States. And I'm happy to see that there are many countries around the world that are now embracing the PA concept, and I do expect it to grow globally as well.
Excellent. Yeah, for sure. Well, as you know, there's a lot of additional things going on in terms of post-professional education. Our Doctor of Medical Science program started back in 2018. At that time, we were one of three DMSC programs. As of last week, there are 37 DMSC programs in the country and more to come, but all post-professional, all, PAs who have already graduated. There's a huge debate going on now with AAPA and PAEA about an entry-level doctoral degree in PA education, and we've had a couple of summits over the years looking at that, but it seems to me that we continue to move in that direction. What's your perspective on the issue of an entry-level doctorate?
Well, as you know, I was I graduated with a bachelor's from the University of Florida back in 1992, and I really felt that that was a solid education. I really felt it gave me a clinical foundation. But I do think that the sweet spot is probably a master's, and I say that because it provides you with sort of the additional leadership skills and the writing ability to truly have an impact in the communities in which we work. Now, we are all lifelong learners, and there are dozens of MDs and nurse practitioners and PAs and nurses and allied health professionals who have really expanded my understanding of knowledge, of medical knowledge. And so we never stop learning. We are always improving what we do. My concern is that if we make an entry-level doctoral program, it's going to fall out of reach for some people. And I do think that if we keep it at a master's level, that provides us with both the clinical and academic skill that we need for being an agile profession.
Great. Yeah, a lot of discussion going on about that. Well, let me move to a different topic. I want to talk about your family for a minute. Your family truly embodies international diversity. We talked about that earlier. Your wife is of Russian Armenian descent. Your daughter works as an OMS in Tunis with a South American African husband, and your sons are pursuing careers ranging from film to space medicine. Wow. How was having such a multicultural family influence your approach to cross-cultural medicine and diplomatic relationships? That's a mouthful of a question.
Well, I tell you, my house is like the United Nations every time we sit down for supper, you know. We as a family, we've grown up in a cross-cultural environment. I was just on the phone with my granddaughter tonight, and she counted to 22 for me in English, in Italian, in French, in Arabic, and in Russian. And she's 4 years old. You know, I'm still working on English, you know, and but we as a family have it's been amazing because my kids have grown up overseas. They've grown up internationally. They have friends all over the world. Their understanding of, you know, sort of the international environment, the understanding of, you know, sort of the global perspective is much more, I don't know what to say, elevated than the average American. And it's through that, you know, sort of lifestyle, I guess, you know, it's allowed me to move without as much struggle from country to country and sort of assignment to assignment. And they've varied. I mean, the difference between the workforce in Cambodia is greatly different than that of Frankfurt, Germany, or that of Pretoria, South Africa. And they've all been wonderful experiences, but the sort of the cross-cultural family experience has allowed me to sort of easily move from one setting and location to the next. You know, global health is very dynamic. There's no, you know, and it takes time, you know, and I think that's the one of the things that I really learned is that when you get into a new culture and a new environment, it takes time to just sort of ask why questions, you know, why are things done a certain way? And that's not accusatory, it's just inquisitive to be able to figure out why things are managed, you know, uniquely in one country over the next.
Yeah, very good. Well, Ty, as a graduate of our DMSC program, what advice would you offer our current and prospective students about the value of an impact of pursuing a DMSC?
Well, you know, I'm a fan. I mean, like I said, the program, especially within the global health tract, has been exactly what I do at embassies overseas. I would encourage folks to that are interested in pursuing a doctoral degree to definitely look at the ATSU program. Specifically, in the course, I really found a lot of value in reading what the other students wrote about their clinical practice and their experiences and the challenges that they were experiencing. I was amazed. There were actually two other students in my group that were working internationally. They were working overseas, and so we were able to sort of share somewhat of a unique perspective. perspective from an international healthcare setting, but I was very fascinated to listen or to read what the students from the United States in a wide variety of settings were the challenges that they were experiencing in the United States.
Yeah, and I'm really glad to hear that. We sometimes get pushback from our DMSA students saying that why do we have these discussions? Why are they valuable? Just give me a book to read kind of thing. But I do hear from a lot of folks that the diversity of experiences is really helpful, and especially if you have people internationally as well. So I'm really glad to hear that. My next question is, you have a, I'm sure you have a demanding schedule where you're at, and I don't know if you have much chance for R&R, but when you do get home, what do you do for enjoyment?
Bangui is considered one of our, there are eight posts in the world which are considered high threat, high risk. And so the usual assignment length is 1 year. I, in a fit of insanity, decided I was going to do 2 years at this high risk, high threat post. And for each year, you get two R&R trips back to the United States. And when you're in a location like this, it's under, I mean, I everywhere I go is with in an armored vehicle with bodyguards, and it's very protected. And so I feel a little bit like I'm under house arrest when I'm here in Bangui. We live on a compound, and 10 laps is 1 mile. And so we call it, pounding the prison yard to get your exercise in. And we've got a prison yard gym that we can do things in. But when I get home, the thing that I love the most is just being able to get outside and not have to have like two goons with, M16s on my shoulders to basically, go for a jog around the lake or, to get out and have a cup of coffee out on the street. So my pleasures are pretty basic when I get back to the United States. I do sort of my extracurricular things while I've been here in country is I love to write, and Randy, as you know, and I actually just on May 16th published my third book, and so and I'm have already started writing the fourth book, which will detail the life of a Foreign Service medical officer.
Well, that's great. Well, that sort of brings up a question I was going to ask earlier. And I don't know the answer to this, but how many PAs are involved with the State Department? Have you had an opportunity to work with many of them, or when they come, you leave, that kind of thing?
So, in most locations, you don't get any overlap with other PAs or nurse practitioners in the Foreign Service. There are a few places. Frankfurt, I did have a nurse practitioner and a German physician who worked for me. In South Africa, I also had a nurse practitioner who worked for me as well. But in most locations, we don't get much overlap. So I was one of the first three PAs hired by the State Department in 1998, full time in 1998, and we have now increased to I think we are at around 90 PAs that work for the State Department, 90 out of about 176, and that is I mean so literally half of all State Department medical attachés are PAs out in the world, and I'm so proud of that. The profession has really represented itself extremely well overseas. The physicians that we work alongside absolutely love the PA profession, and the embassies that we work in, they can't live without us. It is one of the things where there, when I if I go home on R&R, the post is anxious about knowing who's going to cover for me and if they're going to be good enough or as good as the care that I provide for them. So, and I mean, it's a nice feeling. It's a nice feeling to know that your community really respects the care that you provide.
Wow, that's wonderful. 90. That's incredible. I only know two, and I know you and Stu Richards. And if any of the other PAs are like you guys, the State Department is in good hands. What if someone said to, hey, Ty, I'd like to move into the State Department. What kind of what should I do? What kind of a background should I have?
Yeah, so the State Department really wants folks that have a well-rounded set of experience. They want folks that do family practice, that see kids, that can manage prenatal care, that are able to manage emergencies. Like you had mentioned in the introduction, a part of what I do is crisis response for an embassy. I work with diplomatic security. We build plans for what we would do if really, really bad things were to happen in an embassy. And so it's probably one of the things I tell people is that if we're able to take care of an emergency well, everything else will sort itself out. A lot of folks will email me through my LinkedIn page and ask about what are the types of experiences that they should do. And I relate that you want to have solid pediatrics, you want to have solid family practice, and you want to have very good urgent care skill capability. Those are the things that the State Department is really looking for. And amazing that even though we are in a hiring freeze, the State Department is still hiring PAs. So we have a class coming in next month, and then we have another one coming in September for providers that will come in. Unfortunately, we've got 16 of us that are retiring from the Foreign Service. So.
All right. Well, very insightful. Well, I've been doing all the talking here. I'd like to open up the floor for some questions from the folks who are here today. Beth, do we have
Awesome.
any questions?
Yep, we do. Nicole has a question in the chat. She says, over your career, Dr. Flowing, what have you found to be your greatest challenges practicing as a PA outside of cultural or regional differences, and more specifically as a PA? Do those challenges mimic some of the challenges we face in the US? Yeah, so I think one of the greatest challenges is working in very remote and austere locations where you don't have many specialists to refer to. We're very fortunate within the State Department that we have a group of specialists in the Washington, D.C. area that we're able to do telehealth consults with. But there are a lot of times that you are there by yourself, and especially if you've got a really sick patient, you've got to feel really comfortable with being able to maintain and keep them stable, and then work on getting them medically evacuated to a center of medical excellence. And there have been cases where I have aged precipitously in 36 hours waiting for the aircraft to arrive to be able to get a person flown to London or to Paris or to South Africa.
Wonderful. Thank you. So, Kendra, I know you have a couple of questions.
I do. First of all, I'm in awe of you. What a career. And not only you, but your children and your offspring. And it's really amazing. It's hard enough to practice sometimes as a PA in our country, right? With the cultures that we have, let alone completely. It's just, you're amazing. Sorry about the
We
glasses.
thank you.
I have light sensitivity, so I apologize.
No worries.
And I have another question for you. So, I mean, actually, this is the first question. I just want to tell you
Okay.
how impressed I was with you. When you were in the Soviet Union, I think you said it was around like 1995 or that time. Did you have a young family? Like, if so, did they come with you on all of these trips or?
They have come with me on all of my assignments. So my kids
Wow.
literally have grown up overseas. So the Peace Corps and the State Department will pay for families to send their kids to international schools. And so from kindergarten through high school, they have gone to international schools. Every school has required that they learn a language. Now, my oldest son, I have no idea why he picked it, but he learned ancient Greek. It's like that's a really helpful language, but anyway.
Wow, that's incredible for your children. I mean,
Yes,
that's a
absolutely.
bonus that you probably couldn't even factor in. But wow, looking back, I can see how it's reflected in their lives. I have a son who serves in the Navy, so I just have this love for, I know you don't serve the military, but you serve the employees, right, of the federal government. It's just I really appreciate the service that you render.
Thank you,
Was
Ken.
it competitive to get, or was it and is it competitive to be selected in this role?
At the time when I was hired, I was really myself, Paul McComber, and Cheryl Green, the first three PAs to get hired by the State Department. We were the product of the AAPA lawsuit against the State Department, who said PAs were unqualified to join the Foreign Service. And so I think they, at that time when they picked me, it's because I was already overseas. I was a known quantity to the State Department because I was running a joint medical unit between State and Peace Corps. And so I was an easy fit. The pendulum has swung. They have become, as I say, they become more picky. I don't think they would have chosen me today as opposed to, back in the day. But they truly are looking for folks that are well-rounded. Every year or so, we individuals are selected and assigned, gone through training, get to post, and they go, "Oh, hell no, this is not for me." And basically, the end of that first tour, they're back to the United States. It's not a job for everyone. It really isn't. And it does require a person to feel very comfortable in their own skin, to be able to work in a sometimes a very high pressure diplomatic environment. I've cared for U.S. presidents. I've cared for secretaries of states. I've cared for members of Congress and enough. And enough military brass to start a marching band, So, and they are individuals that that you want your yes to be yes and your no to be a no, that you want to know and that they you want them to know that you know what you're doing.
Well, yes, and you really, by virtue of this position, you're in harm's way, right? I mean, on some level. So it's like really a military full-time PA. I mean, it's just to me, but even harder because you have all of the travel and the culture and everything. But my last question, really quick, because I want to others to ask as well, is now when you're kind of heading into retirement, you went through the doctorate program. What do you plan on doing with your doctorate?
So there are several opportunities that I'm waiting to sort of decide which one I'm going to choose. So there was a good friend that I met while I was posted in Tel Aviv, Israel, that has an NGO that works in three of the largest refugee camps in the world. And he's asked me to come on board and be his chief medical officer. I don't know if I want to do that full time or if I want to basically just be a consultant for him and just kind of pop in and out of the refugee camps. There is another opportunity to do to help build the healthcare system here in the Central African Republic. And that's probably the one that's at the top of my list right now. We are in a venture with a corporation out of Europe that has very deep pockets that are willing to invest several millions of dollars to create a European style self-contained community hospital, which would be the first one that this country's ever had.
That's
And
amazing.
so we will see. This country is very challenging to work with, and there's every opportunity for them to shoot themselves in the foot, but we'll see how the next 6 months pan out.
Well, best of luck to you. Please be safe, and we're all excited for your return. I'd love to have another session, a part two, honestly. I just have all these questions. Okay, I'm done. Bye.
Thank you, Kendra.
All right. Other folks that have questions. Yeah, Melinda.
Hey, Melinda.
Hi, Ty. Good to see you again.
Great seeing you as well.
Yeah, I'm sorry I was late. As you could tell, I'm babysitting my granddaughter, family emergency. I needed to come to St. Louis to do that. So I'm sorry I was late. I was really looking forward to this, and I go, oh no, I'm late. So I apologize for that. So you just had another book came out, huh? Where is it
Right.
being
So
published or distributed?
it's on Amazon.
Okay.
It's called PCMO, Memoir of a Peace Corps Medical Officer. And like I said, it was just released on the 16th of May. So less than a month ago, or just a month ago.
Well, I always use you an example of alternate PA careers, and when I'm teaching in the undergrad, well, in the master's program, PA school, and the invitation is still open for you to zoom in. And now I'm going to be at Mizzou in Columbia, so if you want to zoom into a class or if you're going through Missouri, please let me know because I will work you into the schedule.
Wonderful. No, as I tell my wife, once we're retired, the whole world is on my bid list. So there's all sorts of things that I can do, once we're back into the States. So
That's
I'll stay
right.
in touch, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Great. I know Jim Delaney has something to say. I knew that.
It's good to see you.
Well, Ty, it was a pleasure. I've been promoting you as much as I can because, like Melinda, it was a privilege to have you in class. And I loved what you said about the discussion post because one of the things I tell students all the time that moan and groan about discussion posts is that it's an opportunity for the students to be the teachers. And I think you are a great teacher. I learned a lot from you, and it was a lot of fun to have you in class. What I want to do is invite you to the International PA meeting that's going to be in Pretoria, South Africa, not South Carolina. I don't know if you know about it, but it's coming up late October, October 28th to the 30th or the 31st. So put that on your calendar if you're still in Africa, and if you're not, I'm sure you know how to get there.
What, Jim, what was those dates again?
I think it's October 28th to the 31st.
Okay.
And if you're not just I don't have the website, but Google International PA Society or Association, and that meeting will come up. I plan to attend. I think there's lots of things that you would be a great resource for a lot of PA, a lot of countries which are trying to get PA programs established. Anyway, I'm glad Randy had the opportunity to get you connected to all of us. Truly a privilege, and thank you for all you've done for the PA profession.
Thanks, James. I really appreciate it. And I'll look at this. I'll have to run this by the Minister of Domestic Affairs to see what she wants us to what we're going to be doing. But I would love to be able to get to. And I've got in-laws in South Africa that I can go visit as well. So I will I'll definitely see what I can do to get there.
Excellent. Anybody else have some questions? We're in the home stretch here.
I had a few people ask about your books, and so I put the link to your author's page for Amazon in the chat, as well as your recent article you just had published.
Oh yeah, and I'm working on my capstone was associated with what are the cumulative effects air travel. I'm still working on getting that published, but I'm hoping to have that cross the finish line by the end of the year.
It was an impressive paper, and I learned a lot from just reading your paper about the issues that you were discussing in it. It's quite fascinating.
It's me. Can you send a link?
A
Is
link
it
for what?
possible? Just what you the study you were referring to just now?
Yeah,
About like
Kendra,
yeah,
there's sure, I'd be happy.
I would love it. Oh, I'm sorry, this is Kendra. Sorry. Thank you.
All right.
I just warn you, if you Google Ty Welling, you will find a lot of stuff.
No, wonderful. I would, I mean, I'm happy to do it. Just could you repeat the title so I can write it down?
So, the cumulative effects of frequent long-haul air travel. Now, that article hasn't been published yet.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So the title, do you need the title of the book?
No, it's not the article that you just mentioned. I was interested in looking at
Yeah.
that up, but it hasn't been published. I was just going to look it up to read more about it because I thought it's fascinating. So,
No, and I'm happy to share it. I can send it as sort of a link through Randy to make sure that everybody has a copy of it as well.
that'd be amazing. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Pleasure.
Very good. Anybody else? Last chance. Well, Ty, I'm going to give you the last words before I sign off. Any last words and advice for us?
The The AT Still program is fantastic. I am a fan, and I have encouraged several others that we have been talking about doing a doctorate program, and specifically the global health track. It truly has been worthwhile. I don't regret it at all, and I do plan to continue to use it as I enter into my discovery phase and decide what the next adventure is going to be. And that I thank you all for taking the time to join the call and to listen to my ramblings. And I thank you all very much.
Well, Ty, thank you again and for sharing your time and expertise with our masterclass participants today, particularly because it's after midnight where you're at. Your journey really exemplifies the incredible impact that PAs can have on global health and international relations. So thank you for what you do. And for the rest of the participants, thanks for joining us. We will have another masterclass in July. I haven't set that up yet, but I will certainly reach out and let you know. And like I say to a lot of my students, until next time, I'll see you down the road. Thank you
Thanks,
all.
Randy.
Bye.
Thanks, Ty. Night.
Thanks,
Bye-bye.
Ty. All right. All right. I'm going to bed. Good night,
All right.
people.
Good night.